The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And welcome to the April 4th, 2014 edition of The Week magazine. As usual, we'll start with the main stories and how they were covered. The battle over religious exemptions for companies. What happened? A majority of Supreme Court justices this week appeared sympathetic to two private companies that want to be exempted from the Affordable Care Act's contraception mandate on religious grounds. The landmark case was brought by Hobby Lobby, a private for-profit arts and crafts store owned by evangelical Christians who object to having to provide in their employee health insurance four contraceptives they deem to be forms of abortion, including the morning-after pill and intrauterine devices, IUDs. During 90 minutes of oral arguments this week, conservative justices expressed support for the idea that certain closely held corporations could object to government mandates on religious grounds, as churches and nonprofit religious organizations can. The four liberal justices fiercely objected, arguing that giving companies the right not to cover contraception would hurt their female employees economically and create a slippery slope of exemptions to other medical procedures, such as vaccines and blood transfusions. Could an employer preclude the use of those items as well? Asked Justice Sonia Sotomayor. With the court split along the usual ideological lines, the deciding vote will probably rest with Justice Anthony Kennedy. He expressed sympathy with female workers who might be put in a disadvantageous position by their employer, but seemed concerned about for-profit companies being compelled to pay for abortions. A decision is expected in June. What the editorial said: Hobby Lobby is a secular for-profit corporation that makes billions in profits, said the New York Times. Its owners, David and Barbara Green, are protected by incorporation from any personal legal liability for Hobby Lobby's actions. Yet the Greens want veto power over which methods of birth control their employees choose to use. The only real threat to liberty in this case comes from owners trying to impose their religious beliefs on thousands of employees. The Obama administration needlessly picked this fight, said the Wall Street Journal. It sensibly gave nonprofits and churches an exemption from the contraception mandate, and the administration did not need to force the small number of highly religious business owners with moral aims to implicate themselves in what they consider to be grave moral wrongs. Under the First Amendment, Americans are guaranteed the free expression of religion, said NationalReview.com. That right doesn't end when they go into business. The decision in this case will be only incidentally about what kind of health insurance we have. It will be about what kind of country we have. What the columnist said: Can we really be arguing about birth control in 2014? Asked gynecologist Jean A. Connery and Nancy L. Stanwood in CNN.com. About 98% of women use contraception at some point. As for the IUD, it's 20 times more effective than the birth control pill and costs upward of $400. So leaving it out of health coverage puts a real burden on low-wage employees. Science has also proven that it prevents fertilization and thus does not cause abortions. Are we really ready to give corporations the right to control the lives of their employees? said Gene Robinson in the DailyBeast.com. Under Hobby Lobby's argument, I could argue that my religion teaches that races were unequal and should be kept separate, or that women can't be supervisors. There would be no end to the chaos that would cause. Hobby Lobby deserves special consideration, said Ken Starr in USAtoday.com. The Green family's Christian beliefs permeate every aspect of the company's practices. Christian music plays in the stores, which are closed on Sunday, and millions in profits are donated to Christian charities every year. Hobby Lobby already provides 16 of the 20 contraceptives mandated by Obamacare. The company just doesn't want to be complicit in providing those abortifacients they find morally repugnant. Progressives thought this case was a slam dunk, said Jay Michelson in the DailyBeast.com. Of course, companies can't pick and choose which laws to obey. But based on the oral arguments, with Kennedy showing apparent sympathy for Hobby Lobby's position, everyone will now be surprised if the Obama administration doesn't lose this case. And our second main story, the final fate of Flight 370. Malaysian officials announced this week that radar data had proven that the missing Flight 370 ended in the southern Indian Ocean as investigators pressed relatives of the pilot, Captain Zahari Ahmad Shah, for information on his behavior leading up to the March 8th flight. New satellite images showed what appeared to be a large debris field of 122 objects scattered over 150 square miles, about 1,550 miles southwest of Perth, Australia. Search teams were trying to track down the pieces in high winds and rough seas, but recovery and confirmation that they were part of the plane could take days or weeks. With the plane under more than 3 miles of ocean, the black box containing data from the flight could take months or longer to find. All 239 passengers and crew are presumed dead. Analysis of radar pings picked up by satellites revealed that the Beijing-bound Boeing 777 had, in fact, headed south after changing course and flew far out over the Indian Ocean, where it presumably crashed after running out of fuel. We don't know why, Malaysia Airlines chief executive Ahmad Johari Yaha said. We don't know how, but Malaysian investigators told USA Today that only the pilot had the expertise to shut down its communication equipment and direct the plane on an evasive course of both high and low altitudes until it crashed. The mystery of where the plane wound up has been solved, said the Dallas Morning News in an editorial, giving heartbroken families the certainty they need to grieve. But another mystery continues to build. Why did the plane's transponder go quiet just before Flight 370 changed course? Was the crew overcome by a suddenly depressurized cabin? Or was there a more sinister reason the plane flew into one of the emptiest parts of the world for 7 straight hours? It looks more and more like a suicidal plot, said Lee Moran in the New York Daily News. A friend of Shah's told a New Zealand newspaper this week that the pilot's marriage was breaking up and that his wife and 3 children had just moved out. The pilot was also conducting a troubled relationship with another woman, the friend said. With all that was happening in his life, the friend said, Shah was probably in no state of mind to be flying. As we finally get some weather that feels like a real springtime around here, I thought you might appreciate this short blurb from the editor-in-chief, William Falk, of The Week magazine. In ancient times, human beings worried every winter that spring, with its warming sun, would never come. They had no inkling that they lived on a spinning globe whose tilted axis exposed them to varying intensities of sunlight, thus producing the seasons. All they knew was that their world had been cold and dark for months. If the gods were angered by humankind's folly, would the life-giving warmth never return? In this first week of a false spring, it's an anxiety I've come to share. As I write this, it's 30 degrees and wintry gray in most of the east, with a huge storm dumping yet more snow on Washington, D.C. and New England. The tender shoots of hyacinths and crocuses in my yard, which only recently emerged from a 2-foot-deep glacial crust, are cowering under a heartless wind. The relentless cold is the first complaint on everyone's lips. Will this ever end? A woman I didn't know said to me as we passed, shivering in our winter coats on the street. All over the planet, people could be forgiving for wondering if the gods were angry. Thus far in 2014, truly bizarre weather has been the norm. Blizzards buried Birmingham, Alabama, and Tokyo, while it hit 62 degrees in Alaska in January. California suffered through its worst drought in more than a century, while the wettest winter since 1766 submerged much of England in a biblical flood. Australia was so hot, 110 degrees for days at a time, that 1,000 bats fell out of the trees, dead of heat stroke. Our ancestors surely would be frightened. What punishing extremes lie ahead this summer? Today we know better than to blame the gods, but I plan to sacrifice a chicken to appease them, just in case. And our controversy of the week, Putin adjusting to his new world order. Vladimir Putin has left the West with no choice but to face reality, said Ann Applebaum in Slate.com. Russia will never be like us. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, U.S. policy toward our former rival superpower has been premised on the notion that Russia is at its heart a flawed Western country, sheepishly trying to work its way back into the family of civilized nations after a century lost to communism. Russia's seizure and annexation of the Crimea region in Ukraine, however, has ended that delusion. The truth is that Russia is an anti-Western power with a different, darker vision of global politics. Putin will not stop with Crimea, said Oleg Shinkarenko in thedailybeast.com. The autocratic former KGB officer is now fervently trying to persuade his people that they have every right to rebuild their former empire. And with his approval ratings soaring to 80%, Russians appear to believe him. The West's targeted economic sanctions and the suspension of Russia's G8 membership may not blunt his ominous momentum as Russian troops mass on the borders of Moldova and East Ukraine. There's no need for panic, said George Packer in NewYorker.com. It would be naive to take Putin at his word that Russia has no designs on territory outside Crimea, and we should use all the non-military means at our disposal to keep him out of the rest of Ukraine and other former Soviet republics. But Putin has no desire or ability to wage a Soviet-style campaign of global conquest. His only real goal is to stay in power. Hence his appetite for continuous crisis and grievance. They distract Russians from their country's economic stagnation and rampant corruption. The smartest response to Putin's provocations, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com, is to quietly remind him of his limitations. The U.S. should flood Ukraine with Western money so it can withstand his economic blackmail and bribery, and tell Ukrainian officials on unencrypted phone lines that we'll send arms and special operations forces to help them resist any Russian occupation. This is a regional conflict, not a global one, and President Obama's goal should be to keep it that way. This isn't the return of the Cold War, said Michael Kimmage in NewRepublic.com. it's worse. Whereas the U.S. and the USSR posed equal existential threats to each other, Putin feels unilaterally endangered. He believes, correctly, that the U.S. and the European Union are plotting to push the West's borders ever eastward, until even Russia is but a European suburb. From Putin's perspective, only aggressive Russian nationalism will save his country from irrelevance. To him, peace and cooperation with the West are the same as surrendering to it. Now America must adjust to Putin's New World Order, said Robert Samuelson in the Washington Post. Since the end of the Cold War, we've been operating under the assumption that the entire world would soon share our values, and that the growing economic interdependence of nations had made territorial wars a relic of the past. In watching Putin defy sanctions to grab Crimea, we're relearning an old lesson. History, culture, geography, religion, and pride often trump economics. We've seen it in the Middle East, China, and now Russia, said David Ignatius, also in the Washington Post. The American model of a free and open society is not inevitable. The battle for democracy is fought anew every time, and nowhere is it preordained that the good guys will win. It was a good week for closing the sale. After Katie Francis of Oklahoma City broke an all-time record by selling 18,107 boxes of Girl Scout cookies in a 7-week sales period, working up to 13 hours a day. She's a real go-getter, said her mom. It was a good week for classroom discipline. After a French math teacher began writing spoilers from Game of Thrones on the blackboard every time the students became too noisy. The tactic produces what one student described as a religious silence. It was a good week for Waldo, a 1,800-pound steer, after he kicked down a gate and escaped a North Dakota slaughterhouse and was then adopted by a Michigan animal sanctuary. He doesn't know how lucky he is yet, said the farmer who sold him, but he'll figure it out soon. It was a bad week for calling 911 after a sick Washington, D.C. woman summoned an ambulance, but had to take a subway to the hospital when two paramedics got into such a heated argument they ignored her. It was a bad week for loving your cell phone after a man jumped onto New York subway tracks to retrieve his and had to press himself in a gap as a train passed over him. After the train screeched to a halt, the man climbed out from under it and ran away. It was a bad week for going to the circus after three angry elephants escaped handlers at the Mula Shrine Circus in Missouri and went on a rampage in the parking lot, smashing cars and RVs. Things started shaking, said a witness. I looked up and saw three elephants coming toward us. You could tell they were upset. Over on the briefing page, Africa's anti-gay crackdown. Uganda and Nigeria have launched campaigns to ban homosexuality and throw gays in jail. Why now? What is the goal of the new laws? To criminalize homosexuality and cleanse these two countries' societies of gay people. In January, Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan signed a new anti-gay law that mandates 14-year prison terms for anyone in a same-sex union and 10 years for anyone who promotes homosexuality, including HIV/AIDS workers. In February, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni signed an even more draconian anti-gay law that provides for 14 years in jail for first-time offenders, those who commit aggravated homosexuality, repeated gay sex, or gay sex involving a minor or someone with HIV, can get life in prison. The Ugandan law also pressures people to inform on their gay neighbors, because it is now a crime for anyone who is aware of homosexual activity to fail to report it. In signing the law, Museveni said he is defending the country from arrogant and careless Western groups that are fond of coming into our schools and recruiting young children into homosexuality. What prompted the new laws? Under legal systems set up by European colonizers in the 19th and 20th centuries, 38 of Africa's 55 nations have had anti-sodomy laws on the books. But those laws were rarely enforced until recently. And in many African cultures, casual homosexuality has been fairly commonplace. In the last two decades, the continent has undergone a resurgence of evangelical Christianity, propelled largely by American missionaries. Uganda has been a particular focus for Scott Lively, an American evangelical pastor who preaches that gay Nazis were behind the Holocaust and that gay men try to recruit children. In a 2009 presentation to Ugandan lawmakers in Kampala, Lively warned that Westerners wanted to undermine the Ugandan family and recruit children by spreading the disease of homosexuality. "They're looking for other people to be able to prey upon," Lively said. Ugandan rights advocates say the anti-gay movement owes everything to Lively's lobbying. "The bill is essentially his creation," said Frank Mugisha of Sexual Minorities Uganda. Why did Lively's campaign succeed? The theory that decadent Westerners are trying to pervert Africans meshed perfectly with the broader anti-colonial themes championed by many African politicians. Uganda's Museveni opposed the law at first, but with a re-election bid coming up, he changed his tune. The West, he said, was engaging in social imperialism by trying to force Uganda and other African countries to recognize gay rights through UN human rights treaties. This rhetoric echoes across many other African countries, but not all. Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe says homosexuality is a Western invention intended to disturb the African moral fabric. Gambian President Yahya Jammeh called homosexuality satanic. Even Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, a Harvard-educated Nobel laureate, has defended her country's anti-sodomy laws as traditional values. What effect do the laws have? Gays are being arrested and being beaten by mobs. In February in Abuja, the Nigerian capital, a mob attacked and brutally beat and kicked a dozen gay men, nearly killing one man. They dragged four of the injured victims to the police station to be arrested for homosexuality, and there the police joined in the beating. Activists say Nigerian police have arrested gay men and tortured them into revealing the names of others. In Uganda, as soon as the law passed, one tabloid ran the cover story, "Exposed, Uganda's 200 Top Homos Named," including photos. Among those named were a hip-hop star and a Catholic priest. Many gay Nigerians and Ugandans are now trying to find asylum abroad. "Our clients are terrified," said Jocelyn Dyer of Human Rights First, a Washington, D.C.-based group that represents asylum seekers. "These laws are emboldening mobs, and the long prison sentences are making it harder to flee and get protection." What is the public health impact? By driving homosexuality deep into the closet, the laws may interfere with the fight against HIV/AIDS. Uganda was once an AIDS success story, but that is now changing. The portion of the population that identifies as gay is tiny. But there are many more men in Uganda and across Africa who have sex with other men but do not identify as gay or bisexual. These men, many of them married, are now less likely to be honest with health care providers and less likely to get the education, free condoms, and HIV testing they need. They are also more likely to contract the virus and spread it to their female and male partners. In Senegal, after several HIV prevention workers were imprisoned in 2008, the number of men seeking sexual health services in that area dropped sharply. How has the West reacted? President Obama called the Ugandan law a step backwards for all Ugandans and said the U.S. was considering revoking aid. Three European countries have already cut aid to Uganda, while the European Parliament has recommended targeted sanctions, including travel and visa bans, against the key individuals responsible for drafting and adopting the laws in both Nigeria and Uganda. But in Africa, Western criticism only feeds into the belief that rejection of homosexuality is an African nationalist cause. The West can keep their aid to Uganda over homos, said Ugandan government spokesman Ofwono Opondo. We shall still develop without it. And we turn now to the best columns from the U.S. The first comes to us from Walter Russell Mead at theamericaninterest.com. Putin's Iranian leverage. The next phase of the Ukraine crisis may not take place in Ukraine, but Iran, said Walter Russell Mead. Sergei Ryabkov, Russia's delegate to the West talks with Iran, was quoted as saying last week that if the U.S. and Europe keep raising the stakes for Moscow's annexation of Crimea, we will take retaliatory measures as well. He specifically named the talks as a weapon in Russia's tit-for-tat arsenal. Uh-oh. Until recently, Russia may have preferred to keep Iran from getting a destabilizing nuclear weapon. But now that Vladimir Putin's power struggle with President Obama has become personal, his agenda could easily change. If Putin wrecks the talks, it would put Obama into the horrible no-win situation he has spent his whole presidency working to avoid, either accepting Iran as a nuclear power or launching a high-stakes war to disarm the mullahs. Forcing Obama into a corner would be an immensely satisfying foreign policy coup for Putin, who delights in proving that the West's rhetoric is hollow. So beware. If Russia can derail the Iran talks, it will be sorely tempted to try. And this from Jeff Jacoby of the Boston Globe. Pensions that cities can't afford. Public pensions are eating taxpayers alive, said Jeff Jacoby. Retirement payments for public workers have become such a staggering financial burden that some cities, including Vallejo, California, Central Falls, Rhode Island, and Detroit, already have been driven to bankruptcy. Even Democratic mayors like Chicago's Rahm Emanuel are pleading for reform. A new study by the American Enterprise Institute shows why. In the average state, a typical career government retiree has an income higher than 72% of all full-time workers. Not including health benefits, the average pension for a single public worker pays out lifetime benefits worth $768,940. In some states, the payout tops $1 million. For struggling taxpayers footing the bill, these gold-plated pensions are an onerous burden. The costs are both driving up state and local taxes and forcing municipalities to lay off cops, cut school funding, and stop repairing roads. This is insanity. Public employees deserve to retire comfortably, but not with lavish benefit checks and health coverage far beyond what private workers can expect. The time for reform is now, and the pension bomb ticks ever louder. And finally, from Kevin Drum at MotherJones.com, when excess no longer sells. A few years ago, said Kevin Drum, I remember walking into Barnes & Noble and being astonished at the overwhelming number of right-wing polemics on display. About 40 tables were loaded with bestsellers such as Jonah Goldberg's Liberal Fascism and Ann Coulter's Godless. Publishers launched 6 special imprints devoted to conservative books, and the genre flourished. But the boom is over. BuzzFeed.com reported last week that most conservative-oriented books now have anemic sales, with many titles failing to make back the author's advance. The problem? Too many authors flooded into a narrow market that hasn't grown since the 1990s. So to attract attention online and on talk radio, their premises and rhetoric began to get more and more extreme. Barack Obama's election drove conservatives into such frenzies of hysteria that they started producing books such as Jerome R. Corsi's Where's the Birth Certificate? A diatribe that claims to prove that the president was actually born in Indonesia. To compete for airtime and sales, Coulter and other right-wing bomb throwers wrote even more hysterical screeds, driving all but the hardcore ditto heads away. When everyone turns the dials to 11, you aren't a niche anymore. You're just a crackpot fringe. While we're here, I thought you might appreciate this blurb about a North Carolina woman that made the It Must Be True, I Read It in the Tabloid section. A 64-year-old North Carolina woman was charged with assault after she allegedly started a food fight at the salad bar during the Golden Corral restaurant's Early Bird Special. Police said Polly Richards was livid about being cut off in line by Linwood Moore, 69. So she banged into him, slapped him, and then threw a plate of food that hit another patron. When police arrived to break up the fracas, they said, Richards told them, just take me to the effing jail then. Proud of our home state we are. We'll turn over to our in-depth article, The Last Word, now. The title is, You're Under Surveillance. In private online forums, at malls, and even at home, said Julia Angwin, someone is tracking you. Sharon and Bilal couldn't be more different. Sharon Gill is a 42-year-old single mother who lives in a small town in southern Arkansas. She ekes out a living trolling for treasures at yard sales and selling them at a flea market. Bilal Ahmed, 36, is a single Rutgers-educated man who lives in a penthouse in Sydney, Australia. He runs a chain of convenience stores. Although they have never met in person, they became close friends on a password-protected online forum for patients struggling with mental health issues. Sharon was trying to wean herself from antidepressant medications. Bilal had just lost his mother and was suffering from anxiety and depression. From their far corners of the world, they were able to cheer each other up in their darkest hours. Sharon turned to Bilal because she felt she couldn't confide in her closest relatives and neighbors. I live in a small town, Sharon told me. I don't want to be judged on this mental illness. But in 2010, Sharon and Bilal were horrified to discover that they were being watched on their private social network. It started with a break-in. On May 7, 2010, patients like me noticed unusual activity on the Mood forum where Sharon and Bilal hung out. A new member of the site, using sophisticated software, was attempting to scrape or copy every single message off patients like me's private Mood and multiple sclerosis forums. Patients like me managed to block and identify the intruder. It was the Nielsen Company, the media research firm. Nielsen monitors online buzz for its clients, including drug makers. On May 18th, patients like me sent a cease and desist letter to Nielsen and notified its members of the break-in. But there was a twist. Patients like me used the opportunity to inform members of the fine print they may not have noticed when they signed up. The website was also selling data about its members to pharmaceutical and other companies. The news was a double betrayal for Sharon and Bilal. Not only had an intruder been monitoring them, but so was the very place that they considered to be a safe space. Even worse, none of it was necessarily illegal. Nielsen was operating in a gray area of the law, even as it violated the terms of service at patients like me. And it was entirely illegal for patients like me to disclose to its members in its fine print that it would sweep up all their information and sell it. We are living in a dragnet nation, a world of indiscriminate tracking where institutions are stockpiling data about individuals at an unprecedented pace. The rise of indiscriminate tracking is powered by the same forces that have brought us the technology we love so much. Powerful computing on our desktops, laptops, tablets, and smartphones. Before computers were commonplace, it was expensive and difficult to track individuals. Governments kept records only of occasions such as birth, marriage, property ownership, and death. Companies kept records when a customer bought something and filled out a warranty card or joined a loyalty club. But technology has made it cheap and easy for institutions of all kinds to keep records about almost every moment of our lives. The combination of massive computing power, smaller and smaller devices, and cheap storage has enabled a huge increase in indiscriminate tracking of personal data. The trackers include many of the institutions that are supposed to be on our side, such as the government and the companies with which we do business. Of course, the largest of the dragnets appear to be those operated by the U.S. government. In addition to its scooping up vast amounts of foreign communications, the National Security Agency is also scooping up Americans' phone calling records and internet traffic, according to documents revealed in 2013 by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. Meanwhile, commercial dragnets are blossoming. AT&T and Verizon are selling information about the location of their cell phone customers, albeit without identifying them by name. Mall owners have started using technology to track shoppers based on the signals emitted by the cell phones in their pockets. Retailers such as Whole Foods have used digital signs that are actually facial recognition scanners. Online, hundreds of advertisers and data brokers are watching as you browse the web. Looking up blood sugar could tag you as a possible diabetic by companies that profile people based on their medical condition and then provide drug companies and insurers access to that information. Searching for a bra could trigger an instant bidding war among lingerie advertisers at one of the many online auction houses. In 2009, 15-year-old high school student Blake Robbins was confronted by an assistant principal who claimed she had evidence that he was engaging in improper behavior in his home. It turned out that his school had installed spying software on the laptops that it issued to the school's 2,300 students. The school's technicians had activated software on some of the laptops that could snap photos using the webcam. Blake's webcam captured him holding pill-shaped objects. Blake and his family said they were Mike and Ike candies. The assistant principal believed they were drugs. Blake's family sued the district for violating their son's privacy. The school said the software had been installed to allow technicians to locate the computers in case of theft. However, the school did not notify students of the software's existence, nor did it set up guidelines for when the technical staff could operate the cameras. An internal investigation revealed that the cameras had been activated on more than 40 laptops and captured more than 65,000 images. Some students were photographed thousands of times, including when they were partially undressed and sleeping. The school board later banned the school's use of cameras to surveil students. On April 5, 2011, John Gass picked up his mail in Needham, Massachusetts, and was surprised to find a letter stating that his driver's license had been revoked. "I was just blindsided," John said. John is a municipal worker. He repairs boilers for the town of Needham. Without a driver's license, he could not do his job. He called the Massachusetts Registry of Motor Vehicles and was instructed to appear at a hearing and bring documentation of his identity. They wouldn't tell him why his license was revoked. When John showed up for his hearing, he learned that the RMV had been using facial recognition software to search for identity fraud. The software compared license photos to identify people who might have applied for multiple licenses under aliases. The software had flagged him and another man as having similar photos and had required them to prove their identities. John was a victim of what I call the police lineup, dragnets that allow the police to treat everyone as a suspect. This overturns our traditional view that our legal system treats us as innocent until proven guilty. The most obvious example of this is airport body scanners. The scanners conduct the most intrusive of searches, allowing the viewer to peer beneath a person's clothes without any suspicion that the person being scanned is a criminal. In fact, the burden is on the individual to prove his or her innocence by passing through the scanner without displaying any suspicious items. John Gass, luckily, was given a chance to plead his case. But it was an absurd case. He was presented with a photo of himself from 13 years ago. "It doesn't look like you," said the officer. "Of course it doesn't," John said. "It's 13 years later. I was 100 pounds lighter." John presented his passport and his birth certificate, and his license was reinstated. But the officers wouldn't give him any paperwork to prove that it was reinstated. He wanted a piece of paper to show his boss that he was okay to drive again. John filed a lawsuit against the RMV, claiming that he had been denied his constitutionally protected rights to due process. The RMV argued that he had been given a window of opportunity to dispute the revocation because the letter had been mailed on March 24th and the license wasn't revoked until April 1st. John didn't pick up his mail until April 5th. The Suffolk County Superior Court granted the RMV's motion to dismiss. Gass appealed, but the appellate court also ruled against him. John felt betrayed by the whole process. He now is very careful around state police because he worries that he won't be treated fairly. "There are no checks and balances," he said. It is only natural humans are going to make mistakes, but there is absolutely no oversight. These stories illustrate a simple truth. Information is power. Anyone who holds a vast amount of information about us has power over us. At first, the information age promised to empower individuals with access to previously hidden information. We could comparison shop across the world for the best price, for the best bit of knowledge, for the people who shared our views. But now the balance of power is shifting, and large institutions, both governments and corporations, are gaining the upper hand in the information wars by tracking vast quantities of information about mundane aspects of our lives. Now we are learning that people who hold our data can subject us to embarrassment, or drain our pocketbooks, or accuse us of criminal behavior. This knowledge could, in turn, create a culture of fear. Consider Sharon and Bilal. Once they learned they were being monitored on patients like me, Sharon and Bilal retreated from the internet. Bilal deleted his post from the forum. He took down the drug dosage history that he had uploaded onto the site. Sharon stopped using the internet altogether and doesn't allow her son to use it without supervision. They started talking by phone but missed the online connections they had forged on patients like me. I haven't found a replacement, Sharon said. Bilal agreed. The people on PLM really know how it feels. But neither of them could tolerate the fear of surveillance. Sharon said she just couldn't live with the uncertainty of not knowing if every keystroke I'm making is going to some other company, she said. Bilal added, I just feel that the trust was broken. Sharon and Bilal's experience is a reminder that for all its technological pyrotechnics, the glory of the digital age has always been profoundly human. Technology allows us to find people who share our inner thoughts, to realize we're not alone, but technology also allows others to spy on us, causing us to pull back from digital intimacy. When people ask me why I care about privacy, I always return to the simple thought that I want there to be safe, private spaces in the world for Sharon and Bilal, for myself, for my children, for everybody. I want there to be a room in the digital world for letters sealed with hot wax. Must we always be writing postcards that can and will be read by anyone along the way? This article was excerpted from Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance by Julia Angwin, that's A-N-G-W-I-N, published in February 2014. Couple of food items on the health and science page this week. How dark chocolate helps us. The secret to dark chocolate's health benefits may be in our guts. New research has found that bacteria in our stomachs feast on indigestible part of cocoa, fermenting it into anti-inflammatory compounds that are good for the heart. The Los Angeles Times reports. The key lies in antioxidants called polyphenols, which are found in dark chocolate and cocoa powder, as well as dark berries and black tea. The molecules in many polyphenols are too large to be absorbed through the stomach wall into the blood to be used as nutrients, which is where intestinal microbes lend a hand. In an experimental setting in the lab, researchers found that bifidobacterium and lactic acid bacteria broke the polyphenols down into smaller molecules capable of making it into the blood. When these compounds are absorbed into by the body, they lessen the inflammation of cardiovascular tissue, reducing the long-term risk of stroke, Louisiana State University food science Professor John Finley says. The amount of cocoa powder needed to produce benefits is about 2 tablespoons per day. And the health scare of the week. Were doctors wrong about fat? After 4 decades of persistent warnings that saturated fat should be avoided in healthy diets, new research is casting doubt on that claim. An extensive new analysis of nearly 80 studies involving 660,000 people has found no evidence linking the fats in meat, butter, and cheese to an increased risk of heart disease, reports the New York Times. Researchers also found no firm evidence that unsaturated fats, such as the omega-3 fatty acids in salmon, reduce heart disease rates. Taken together, the findings further muddy the waters in the ongoing debate about what's best to eat. These are interesting results that encourage careful reappraisal of our current nutritional guidelines, said researcher Rijav Chowdhury in the University of Cambridge. While saturated fats are known to increase LDL, or bad cholesterol, the new findings suggest that the relationship between cholesterol and heart disease is more complicated than previously thought. Researchers did confirm, however, that the much maligned trans fat, the partially hydrogenated oils found in processed foods, do have a direct link to heart disease. And on the Talking Points page, Justice Ginsburg, time to retire? If Ruth Bader Ginsburg cares about her liberal legacy, she should step down from the Supreme Court, says Erwin Chemerinsky in the Los Angeles Times. The 81-year-old justice, having survived two bouts with cancer, is by all accounts healthy and mentally fit. But only by resigning by this summer can she ensure that a Democratic president will be able to choose her successor. The court now has four conservative justices, and if the next president were to appoint a fifth, it could tip the court into a radically conservative direction on such vital issues as environmental protection, same-sex marriage, women's rights, and abortion. President Obama also will have the best chance of getting his nominee confirmed if Democrats still control the Senate, an advantage that could disappear with November's midterms. Retiring now is the best way for Ginsburg to advance all the things she has spent her life working for. Justice Ginsburg doesn't need your advice, said Dahlia Lithwick in Slate.com. To suggest that this meticulous and passionate legal mind doesn't understand real-world politics is insulting and a little sexist. Do Ginsburg's critics think she has forgotten her age, or her medical history, or the date of the upcoming election? Ginsburg clearly loves her work on the court, said Garrett Epps in The Atlantic, and rarely misses a day. If she were to retire, that center would drop out of her life. She tartly told an interviewer last year that there will be another president, which sounds like she's betting that Hillary Clinton wins in 2016. That's a very high-stake gamble, said Isaac Chotiner in The New Republic. If a Republican is the next president instead of Hillary, the real losers will be women who want to control their bodies, minorities who want to vote in southern states, and citizens who don't want their votes overwhelmed by unlimited contributions from billionaire donors and corporations. So Ginsburg's personal feelings are nowhere near the most important issue. This uncomfortable argument only proves the need for judicial term limits, said Scott Lemieux in The American Prospect. If justices served for a fixed period instead of a lifetime term, it would ensure that judicial appointments are evenly distributed among presidents and lower the stakes of each appointment. It would also relieve aging justices of the burden of knowing when to pack it in. And another Talking Points article, guns, when even discussion is taboo. The National Rifle Association just vetoed a presidential appointment, said Zoe Carpenter in The Nation. President Obama had nominated a widely respected Harvard Medical School physician, Dr. Vivek Murthy, for the U.S. Surgeon General's position. But after the NRA branded Murthy a radical anti-gun nominee, 10 Senate Democrats facing tough re-election campaigns said they might join the 45 Republicans in opposing Murthy. Why? Murthy, who has seen the carnage caused by firearms while working in emergency rooms, has said that guns are a health care issue and has suggested that doctors talk to patients about gun safety in their homes. In his confirmation hearing, Murthy said he planned to use the office to campaign against obesity, not for gun control. But the NRA is now so extreme that it wants to make discussion of gun violence taboo. Murthy is clearly qualified, said the New York Times in an editorial. So why are Democrats knuckling under to the gun lobby? Murthy was a poor choice for a Surgeon General, said the Washington Times. He's more political activist than physician, with a long history of hostility toward the constitutional right to bear arms. He has advocated that doctors talk to patients about the dangers of gun ownership, and that's particularly worrisome since the fact that they own a gun would be entered into their records. In opposing Murthy's nomination, the NRA acted like any other lobbying group, said Charles C.W. Cook in NationalReview.com. It just so happens that the right to keep and bear arms is popular in the United States. If Obama's nominee goes down in flames, there will be only one group to blame, the people. And we'll wind down with a few notes here. California is now home to 111 billionaires, by far the most of any state. And they personally hold assets worth $485 billion, more than the entire GDP of all but 24 countries in the world. Yet the state also suffers the highest poverty rate in the country, adjusted for housing cost at 24%. None of the millions of fans who submitted brackets will beat the 9.2 quintillion to one odds and win Warren Buffett's $1 billion prize for perfectly predicting each winning team in the NCAA College Basketball Championship Tournament. All entries, in fact, got at least one game wrong in the first round of 32 games. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.